I grew eyes so you could see. I built a marvelous brain so you could think and dream. My arms and hands have let you hold those you love. I've enabled you to walk and work, dance and sing, and enjoy so much pleasure. Scan the major parts of your body from feet to head. See if you can appreciate each one of them. Perhaps saying to yourself things like, feet, thank you for carrying me along. Thighs, you've done your job countless times, and I'm very grateful. Heart and lungs, all those beats and breaths. Oh my goodness, I so appreciate you. Hands and hips, I accept you as you are. Chest and arms, neck and shoulders, head and hair, thank you for everything you've done for me. Imagine your body in the days to come. See yourself in different situations over the next year, perhaps with friends, at work, or at family gatherings, and imagine that you completely accept your body in these situations. Imagine that you really appreciate your body in these situations. Imagine that you enjoy your body in them. Be aware of how good it would feel to relate to your body in these ways that I've suggested here. Let these good feelings sink into you as you sink into them. Nurturing your body. Physical health is a tremendous aid to resilience, and the most consequential threats to safety are threats to the body. As a psychologist, I'm not offering medical advice, but the common sense basics are obvious. Have a balanced and nourishing diet, get a good night's sleep, exercise regularly, minimize or eliminate intoxicants, and act early to assess and treat potential health problems. Most people know what they should do. The key is drawing on agency and determination to do it. Consider the list I just went through and see if there are any actions that you think you should take. If there's something you know you should do but you're not doing it, pause and think about the consequences. For what you feel like on a typical day, for other people, for yourself in a year or 10 or 20, consequences for how long and how well you want to live. People commonly put off improving their personal health practices. It's so easy to say, I'll start tomorrow, but the tomorrows keep adding up and the years go by. Then something comes along, an injury, serious illness, or major stressor that lands hard on a weakened constitution, like a tree branch falling on a house hollowed out by termites. It's motivating, not morbid, to realize that we're all running out of runway, that it's time to change something that could add quality years to your life. Imagine how good it will feel to make that change. Take a little time to imagine the sense of health and energy in your body, the feelings of self-respect, the appreciation of others, the hopeful years ahead with friends and family. If doubts come up about whether you'll stick with the change, simply bring your attention back to a rich experience of the rewards of doing it. Use one or more of the five aspects of the enrich step in heal to strengthen the experience. Stay with it, help it be more intense, open to it in your body, find something new or fresh about it, and recognize how it is personally valuable to you. All this will tend to be motivating, inclining your brain toward this new behavior. Then, of course, make the change. Look for simple, practical ways to support yourself. For example, if you want to cut down on the carbohydrates you eat, Have a salad with some protein for lunch and don't bring home a box of donuts. If you want to get more sleep, turn off the TV by 10 o'clock. If you need more exercise, set up a regular walk with a friend. If alcohol is tempting, keep it out of your house. And when you do take action, even in small ways, pause for a moment and really feel the rewards of doing so. I don't mean to trivialize how hard it can be to adopt a new health habit. I've had my own struggles, for sure. But your odds of success go up dramatically when you tend to the causes in three ways. Recognize the need for a change, take appropriate actions, and internalize experiences of the rewards that come to you. Keep watering the tree, and most likely, it will bear you good fruit. Key points. Just a few experiences of being trapped, powerless, and defeated can lead to learned helplessness, which undermines coping and ambition and is a risk factor for depression. So, it's important to look for what you can do, if only inside your mind, especially in challenging situations or relationships. In so much of life, you can tend to the causes, but you can't control the results. Knowing this fosters both responsibility and inner peace. Use the heal steps to internalize experiences of resolve, patience, and persistence. Mental health is sometimes framed as suppressing our primal animal nature. But then parts of the self that are wild and wonderful get locked away. Being able to tap into a fierce, feral intensity makes a person more resilient. How you feel about and treat your body affects your health and vitality, and these in turn affect your thoughts, feelings, and actions. Just as you probably don't care much about what others look like, most if not all people are not critical of your body. Accept your body for what it is and focus on what you appreciate about it. Don't put off sensible actions for your physical health. It's always easy to start tomorrow. Instead, ask yourself, what can I do today? Chapter 5, Gratitude. Piglet noticed that even though he had a very small heart, it could hold a rather large amount of gratitude. A.A. Milne. Gratitude and other positive emotions have many important benefits. They support physical health by strengthening the immune system and protecting the cardiovascular system. They help us recover from loss and trauma. They widen the perceptual field and help us see the big picture and the opportunities in it. They encourage ambition. And they connect people together. We tend to spend our lives seeking to feel good in the future, but this is stressful and tiring in the present. With gratitude, you feel good already. So let's explore how to develop it and other positive emotions by giving thanks, taking pleasure, feeling successful, and being happy for others. Giving thanks. Recall a recent time you gave thanks, out loud or just inside your mind. Perhaps while eating a meal, getting a hug, or looking up at the sky. There's a natural feeling in the body when we're thankful, a sense of easing, a need met, satisfaction. Think about some of what you've been given, such as friendship and love, an education, life itself, and a universe that bubbled into being over 13 billion years ago. And that's just for starters. Alongside whatever is painful or difficult in a person's life, there is always already so much to be thankful for. As a little experiment, bring to mind something that you have been given, and then think or say thank you for it. Thankfulness feels good in its own right. Additionally, Robert Emmons and other researchers have found that it brings a remarkable collection of benefits. These are more optimism, happiness, self-worth, and less envy, anxiety, and depression. Also more compassion, generosity, forgiveness, stronger relationships, and less loneliness, plus better sleep and greater resilience. Ways to grow thankfulness. Thankfulness is not about minimizing or denying hassles, illness, loss, or injustice. It is simply about appreciating what is also true, such as flowers and sunlight, paper clips and fresh water, the kindness of others, easy access to knowledge and wisdom, and light at the flick of a switch. Be mindful of any reluctance to see these gifts, such as a concern that this will make you lose track of problems or lower your guard. It helps to remember that you can be deeply thankful while maintaining a sharp-eyed clarity about what could go wrong. When there is pain in life, see if there are any gifts that come along with it. For example, our kids have grown up and left home and we miss them dearly, but there's also great appreciation for their blossoming as adults. One of the key findings of the research on gratitude is the striking value of celebrating the gifts of life with others. I remember sitting with my wife and 100 other parents at an event at our daughter's preschool, watching the kids perform little skits and singing together. It was so sweet, and we felt so grateful for our children and their teachers. Try to make thankfulness a regular part of your day. For instance, you could put a reminder to give thanks beside your desk or on your car's dashboard. You could keep a journal of things you're thankful for, or write a letter to someone saying what you appreciate about that person. One powerful method is to reflect on 3 blessings in your life before falling asleep. Help the recognition of what you've received become feelings of appreciation, reassurance, and even awe and joy. Use the heal steps to take these feelings into yourself, sinking into them as they sink into you. The experiential practice that follows will give you an extended sense of this. Experiential practice, being thankful. Take a breath and relax. Think of someone you really appreciate. What are some of the things that this person has given to you? Let these memories become feelings of thankfulness and let those feelings sink in. Think about what has been fortunate in your life, such as your natural talents, when or where you were born, who your parents were, good luck that has come to you. Without taking away from your own efforts, open to feeling thankful for your good fortune. Consider the world of nature, the beauty of flowers, the trees, flocks of birds, all the life in the ocean. In your mind or out loud, see what happens when you say thank you. Let your thanks fill your heart and ripple outward. Consider some of the many objects you use in a day that have been made or invented by other people, often long ago, such as wheels, safety pins and smartphones, soy sauce, street lights and stop signs, and zippers and belt buckles. Handed to you, gifted to you, deserving of your thanks. Step back and think about all the things that have happened to bring our Milky Way galaxy into being. And our solar system, our own sweet planet, life emerging over 3 billion years ago, our own human species appearing, your grandparents being born, and having children who met and had you. So many things coming together to bring you into being. Looking upstream at the river of time, you can see so many things to be thankful for. Wow. Thank you. Taking pleasure. Our pleasures include lovely sights, fascinating ideas, and good times with others. Healthy pleasures crowd out unhealthy ones. After eating an apple, there's less interest in a candy bar. If you're having a stressful or upsetting experience, simple pleasures such as listening to music can move the needle of your internal stressometer out of the red zone and back toward green. And if you use the heal steps to repeatedly internalize experiences of pleasure, over time you will feel increasingly pleased from the inside out. This will help to reduce desires for pleasure from the outside in. Unfortunately, many people do not experience much pleasure. Some of the reasons for this are general. As Soren Kierkegaard wrote, quote, "Many of us pursue pleasure with such breathless haste that we hurry past it," unquote. In fast-paced cultures, it takes a deliberate effort to slow down and relish a pleasure. Other reasons are more individual, and see if any of these apply to you. A person might believe something like, "My role is to make sure that others are enjoying themselves, not me." Or a person might think, "How dare I enjoy this when so many people are suffering?" Or there could be inhibitions against feeling certain pleasures, perhaps because they are associated with shame. If you do find a block to pleasure inside yourself, you can move past it by using the three ways to engage your mind. First, let be. Explore the block with mindfulness and self-compassion. Be curious about how it developed. Second, let go. Relax any tension in your body related to the block. Challenge beliefs associated with it, such as find reasons why they're wrong, and consciously decide that you don't want the block to control you. Third, let in. Say to yourself ideas that contradict the beliefs associated with the block, such as, "I deserve pleasure too." You could also imagine how good it would feel to let yourself have more pleasure. It might seem that there is just no pleasure to be had in a pain-filled life. But if you can accept the fact of the pain, drawing on mindfulness, self-compassion, and other inner resources to help you bear it, that will make more room for pleasure. Your attention will not be so caught up in resistance to pain, and you will be freer to recognize and enjoy everything else. Taking pleasure is itself an expression of agency. Even in the worst of times, there are opportunities for simple pleasures. A sip of water in a parched mouth, the call of a bird, a memory of kindness, a blade of green grass reaching up through a crack in a dirty sidewalk. I'll never forget visiting a large residential facility for people who were severely developmentally disabled. As I rounded a corner, I saw a young man lying on a cot in the hallway, unable to walk and with an estimated IQ of about 20. And he gave me an incredibly radiant smile, quivering with delight at the pleasure of a human face. A pleasure diary. The harder the life, the more important it is to experience and internalize psychological resources, including a sense of pleasure. A sweet way to do this is to keep a pleasure diary on paper or simply in your mind. To do this, consider some of the many sensory pleasures you might encounter today. Sights of skyscrapers, faces, stones. Sounds of music, water, laughter. Tastes of fruit, tea, cheese. Touches of soft cloth, a child's hand, your pillow. Smells of orange, cinnamon, rose, curry. The pleasures in movement, stretching, walking, running. Also consider mental or emotional pleasures, such as finishing a crossword puzzle or learning an interesting fact. Meditation or prayer can be deeply enjoyable. So can playing music or cooking something new for dinner. It feels good to accept yourself and to let go of thoughts and feelings that have been painful. And of course, there are social pleasures. Laughing together, cooing over a baby, accomplishing something as a team, understanding another person better. All so good. Some of the deepest pleasures are moral. feeling an integrity, knowing that you've done the right thing when it was hard to do. As you go through your day, deliberately flag opportunities for pleasure. On a piece of paper, you could keep count of the pleasures you receive and probably be happily surprised by the total at nighttime. Or simply take a few minutes before sleep to look back over the day and remember some of its many pleasures. Feeling successful. There is an architecture of aims inside us that ranges from microscopic regulatory processes within individual cells all the way up to our loftiest aspirations. Living is inherently goal-directed. Experiences of meeting your goals feel good, lower stress, and build positive motivation. They reassure you that you're making progress, which helps you stay in the responsive mode, in the green zone, as you go through your day. There are outcome goals, such as getting out of bed in the morning, coming to a good understanding with someone at work, and washing the dishes after dinner. And there are process goals, ongoing values and aims, such as being honest, learning and growing, and taking care of your health. If you think about it, you can see that you are accomplishing many outcome and process goals every hour. For example, as you walk across a room, each step is a goal. This may sound trivial, but for a toddler learning to walk, each step is a victory. In a conversation, each word understood and facial expression deciphered is a goal attained. At work, every email read, text sent, and point made in a meeting is an accomplishment. Since each day is full of goals, large and small, it is full of opportunities to take in experiences of successful goal attainment. Doing this builds up an internal sense of being successful, which helps us weather criticism and be less dependent upon the approval of others. Much self-importance and acting superior is a compensation for underlying feelings of failure and inadequacy. Consequently, feeling like a success deep down can help people lighten up and take themselves less seriously. A durable sense of being successful comes from internalizing many experiences of small successes, not from seeing a big trophy outside, such as a fancy car parked in the driveway. Feelings of failure. We all accomplish countless outcome and process goals each day, yet many people do not feel very successful. One reason is the negativity bias. Internal alarms go off when we don't meet goals, and dopamine activity drops in the brain, which feels bad and heightens anxiety, tension, and drivenness. But when we do meet our goals, we often don't recognize it. People can be inattentive or numb as they do one task after another, or so focused on whatever is around the bend that they zoom through the finish line as they rush on to the next race. When you notice an accomplishment, how often do you feel the success, if just for a moment? It's common to block feelings of success due to fears of being ridiculed or punished for standing out or thinking you're somebody special. And when you do have a sense of success, do you slow down to take it in and hardwire it into your nervous system? The number of actual failures in any person's life is tiny compared to the vast number of goals that have been successfully attained. But the failures are highlighted by the brain, associated with painful feelings, and stored deeply in memory. This crowds out a legitimate and well-earned sense of being an accomplished and successful person. The fear of failure is worsened if you grew up with a lot of criticism, even if there was also a lot of love. It's also worsened if you are part of a company, or more broadly an economy, that's incentivized to keep people on the proverbial hamster wheel, with real success always slightly out of reach. Make your first dollar? It's on to the first thousand. Make your $1,000? Well, so-and-so made $10,000. Get promoted? Stay hungry. Win a championship? Better repeat next year. Work harder, stay later, give 110%, but it's never quite enough. The goalposts keep getting pushed back. Feeling afraid of being a loser can be motivating, whether for a child or for a CEO. But over the long haul, those negative feelings wear people down and lower performance. Feeling reasonably successful already helps people aim high, recover from setbacks, and achieve their best. Since you actually are moving from success to success hundreds of times each day, it's simple justice to feel successful. Everyday success. Consequently, try to notice some of the many goals you accomplish daily. Be mindful of succeeding at small outcomes, such as preparing a meal, adding paper to a printer, or reading to a child. Producing even a single small result, let's say eating a spoonful of soup, usually involves many smaller accomplishments, such as holding the spoon, dipping it into the bowl, bringing it to the lips without spilling, getting the soup into the mouth, and returning the spoon to the table. Any one of these little accomplishments is a chance to feel successful. Also notice progress toward big outcomes, such as raising children to be independent adults, completing classes for a degree, or saving money for retirement. Each step may be short, but as the hours and months and years add up, it feels good to realize that you are covering a great distance. Last, recognize that you are continuing to fulfill ongoing process goals. Consider how you've stayed in integrity and functioned appropriately at home and at work. Also think about some of the disasters you've already avoided today. No bad fall in the bathroom, no fire in your home. Really, this is a kind of success too, and it's worth appreciating. Even in a very difficult life, it's possible to feel successful in many ways. The more you feel defeated about some things, the more important it is to recognize your victories in many other things. When you have an experience of success, open to it and take it in using the heal steps. And try the experiential practice that follows for a rich and embodied sense of this. Experiential practice, feeling successful. Take a few breaths and relax. Get a sense of being on your own side. Bring to mind some small outcome goals you've already accomplished today, such as getting out of bed, drinking water, and doing tasks at home or work. Help yourself feel successful at accomplishing these. Open to related feelings of pleasure, reassurance, and worth. Enrich these experiences by sustaining them, feeling them in your body, and recognizing what could be personally important about them. Absorb these experiences by sensing them sinking into you, becoming a part of you, and focusing on what is enjoyable about them. Recognize progress toward big outcomes, such as planting a garden, getting to know a new friend, or preparing for a promotion at work. Let this recognition become an experience of success and take this into yourself. Be aware of fulfilling ongoing process goals, such as still breathing, still going on living, being warm-hearted and fair-minded, making efforts, and enjoying life. Open to a sense of success and related feelings such as contentment. As you experience a sense of success, you can use the link step to connect it with negative material such as disappointments, worries, tension and drivenness, or feeling inadequate. Keep the sense of success prominent in the forefront of awareness and drop the negative material if it grabs you. Imagine the positive making contact with the negative, sifting down into frustrated places inside, perhaps reaching down into experiences of failure when you were younger. Let the sense of success calm, soothe, and bring perspective to the negative material. As you finish, let go of anything negative and simply focus on the sense of success. Being happy for others. Think of a time when you saw a child laughing, heard a friend share some good news, or learned that a coworker had recovered from a serious illness. This is the feeling of being happy for others, sometimes called altruistic joy, and it's grounded in our long history as social beings. Living together in small bands, our hunter-gatherer ancestors flourished when those they lived with flourished as well. Consequently, there was evolutionary pressure to develop both compassion for the suffering of others and happiness for their good fortune. Sometimes we do compete for finite, scarce resources, such as applying for a job. But if things are reasonably fair, we can be good sports and respect the success of others. And most aspects of life are truly win-win. One person's good health, stable marriage, and thriving children do not stop another person from also having these things. That happiness which is always available. To paraphrase the Dalai Lama, if you can be happy when others are happy, you can always be happy, since there is always someone somewhere who is happy. It's easiest to feel glad for family members, friends, and others who've treated you well, but it's also possible to feel happy for challenging acquaintances and even strangers. You can feel happy for individuals and groups, those close to home or far away, pets, and in fact, any living thing. Just as there are many kinds of others, there are many kinds of good fortune. You could be glad about recent events in someone's life, or pleased about ongoing conditions such as health, prosperity, and a loving family. If you know a child, just think about how much he or she is learning each day. Perhaps things are getting better for someone you care about. Just the simple fact that people are alive is reason enough to be happy for them. Think of a time when someone was really glad for you. Perhaps you'd been promoted or a health scare had turned out to be nothing, and see if you can remember how that touched you. Turn it around. The support, recognition, and good wishes that were given to you are exactly what you give to others when you are happy for them. Doing this benefits you even as it benefits others. Altruistic joy feels good, opens the heart, and brings a sense of positive connection to a wider world. Other people sense it when you're happy for them, which strengthens and deepens relationships. An antidote to disappointment and envy. Walking down a busy city street, it's easy to forget that the natural social environment for a human being is a band of about 50 people. This is how we lived for most of our time as a species, and how our tool manufacturing ancestors lived for more than 2 million years before that. Consequently, we've evolved a brain and a mind that are designed for a very specific setting, fairly small groups. Whether that group is a Stone Age tribe, an eighth grade class, or co-workers in an office, it's been important to know where one stands in comparison to others. So we measure ourselves against both friends and rivals. We feel reassured and worthy when it looks like we're doing better than they are, but we tend to feel bad when it looks like we're not. With social media, we compare the entire movie of our lives, whose warts we know painfully well, to the carefully edited highlight reels of everybody else, and it's easy to feel disappointed, diminished, and envious. Happiness for others is a natural antidote to these feelings. It can pull you out of self-critical or bitter preoccupations and shift your mood in a positive direction. But thinking about the good fortune of other people may lead to painful comparisons that block gladness for them. To get through this block, begin by recognizing the blessings that you have received, the joys you have found, the things you have achieved, and the contributions you have made to others. Whatever is good in your life remains good even if another person has something great. Also know that fortunate people suffer too. Like everyone, they face disease, death, and inevitable loss. Remember that whatever is happening in anyone's life is a local ripple in a vast river of causes. Most of those causes are impersonal, such as the luck of the DNA draw or the social class of parents. This means you don't need to take either their ups or your downs so personally. Start with people who are easy to be happy for. When you feel glad for their good fortune, slow down and take it in. Then try this with other people. Do this repeatedly, and you'll develop the habit of being happy for others, a large-hearted way to find a reliable happiness. Key points. We seek to feel good in the future, but this is often stressful in the present. Poignantly, the pursuit of happiness can push it out of reach. With gratitude, we feel good already. Giving thanks for what is beneficial does not prevent us from seeing what is harmful. In fact, the ways that thankfulness supports physical and mental health make us more resilient and more able to deal with challenges. Pleasure is easy to dismiss, but it is a rapid way to lower stress or to disengage from an upset. Wholesome pleasures crowd out unwholesome ones. The more you feel already full of pleasure, the less you'll strain for it outside yourself. Because of the negativity bias, we notice when we fail to reach a goal while missing the fact that meanwhile we're succeeding at hundreds of other goals. Look for opportunities to feel successful many times each day. Take in these experiences and use them to compensate for and heal feelings of failure or inadequacy. If you can be happy about the happiness of others, you can find a lasting happiness. Chapter 6, Confidence. Too many people overvalue what they are not and undervalue what they are. Malcolm Forbes. Two friends of mine had a baby girl when I began writing this book, and now she's a toddler and eagerly walking about. Her parents make sure she doesn't get hurt, and they give her just enough help to get whatever she's trying to touch or taste. If she bonks herself and cries, they're sympathetic and soothing. Before her first birthday, she experienced thousands of brief interactions in which her parents were helpful and encouraging, and in which she felt capable and happy. The essence of these experiences has been woven into her nervous system, building up resources to meet her need for connection. For all of us, this process of learning continues through childhood and into adulthood. Besides parents, it involves siblings and peers, teachers and bosses, friends and enemies. If it goes reasonably well, we acquire a sense of being cared about, worth, and self-assurance that helps us cope with challenges, especially in relationships. We develop confidence in ourselves, in others, and in the world. But if there's been too much disapproval and rejection, and too little encouragement and support, then a person tends to lack confidence and be insecure, self-critical, brittle, and less resilient. To grow the inner strength of confidence, we'll start by grounding this topic in the evolution of the brain and the effects of secure and insecure attachment. Then I'll cover how to feel more secure in the core of your being and stay on an even keel of emotional balance. We'll finish by exploring how to stand up to the inner critic and strengthen your sense of self-worth. The social brain. Our relationships and their effects are the result of the long, slow evolution of the social brain, beginning with the emergence of mammals. Unlike most reptiles and fish, mammals raise their young, frequently bond with a mate, sometimes for life, and live cooperatively in many ways with others of their kind. To manage the complexities of social life, mammals required more information processing power and thus more powerful brains. In proportion to the size of their bodies, mammals usually have bigger brains than reptiles and fish. And only mammals have the six-layered neocortex, the thin and convoluted sheet of tissue that is the outer, quote-unquote, skin of the brain and the neural basis of complex experiences, communications, and reasoning. Their social capabilities have enabled mammals to thrive in an extraordinary range of environments. Seals in Antarctic waters, mice in blistering hot deserts, bats in pitch-dark caves, and propelled one mammal in particular to become the dominant species on the planet. In an evolutionary spiral, the survival benefits of relationships for our primate and human ancestors encouraged the development of a more social brain, which enabled even more complex relationships, which called for an even more capable brain. For example, the more social the primate species, the larger the grooming group, the more complex the alliances and rivalries, the larger the cortex. Since our hominid ancestors began using tools to make more tools about 2.5 million years ago, the brain has tripled in volume. Much of this build-out is devoted to socially relevant capabilities, such as empathy, language, cooperative planning, compassion, and moral reasoning. As the brain grew larger, childhood grew longer. A newborn chimpanzee's brain is half the size of an adult's, but a human baby's brain is just a quarter of the size it will eventually become. Hominid and early human brains needed more time to mature into their full size, which extended the dependency of children on their mothers. A hominid or early human mother tending to a child was less able to gather food, run from a predator, or defend herself. She had to rely on others, including her mate, her kin, and her band. This drove the evolution of human pair bonding, the investment of fathers in childrearing, and the development of the whole village that it takes to raise a child. Being dependent may sound like a weakness, but it is one of our greatest strengths. Spreading to the farthest corners of the globe, even walking upon the moon, humans have become so wildly successful through depending on each other. For example, children on their parents, one parent on another, families on communities, and communities on the many adults who aren't raising children. The root of the word confident means to have trust or faith. If others are dependable, we develop trust in them as well as faith in our own worth. But if others are not dependable, it's normal to develop a sense of inadequacy, self-doubt, even shame. This is particularly true in childhood, when we are both most dependent on others and most affected by our negative experiences. Secure and insecure attachment. Physically, our lives depend upon getting enough air, water, and food. Additionally, we must get social supplies, especially when we're young and need lots of empathy, skillful caregiving, and love. It is our biological nature to need to feel cared about. In fact, we need to feel that we're worth being cared about. For some children and teenagers, these needs are well met, but for others, not so well. The needs of a young person land on parents, siblings, and classmates who have their own needs and issues. With a variety of people, every child naturally, implicitly asks again and again, "Do you see me? Do you care about me? Will you treat me well?" The psyche is built from the bottom up from the residues of countless experiences, and the foundational layers were laid down in the first years of your life. By a child's second birthday, the accumulating effects of many experiences with caregivers usually coalesce into a fundamental attachment style. Through grade school and high school, interactions are shaped by the original attachment style and tend to reinforce it. Unless there has been a major shift, such as through significant personal growth, this style continues to operate deep inside important adult relationships, especially if they are intimate. To simplify a large body of research, when parents and other caregivers are usually attuned, responsive, loving, and skillful, reliably delivering a good enough stream of social supplies, children are likely to become securely attached. They have a feeling of being loved and worthy, as well as strong capacities to soothe and regulate themselves. People with such an internalized, secure base are able to explore the world, tolerate separation, and recover from hurt and disappointment. They're comfortable saying how they feel and what they want, since they've had many experiences in which this went reasonably well. They don't cling to other people or push them away. Deep down, they have a core sense of connection needs met, and their attaching system is centered in the responsive mode. They are confident. On the other hand, When children experience their caregivers as frequently unavailable, insensitive, cold, rejecting, punishing, or abusive, then they are likely to become insecurely attached. As a side point, there are three types of insecure attachment: avoidant, ambivalent, and disorganized. And my summary here won't explore the distinctions among them. People with the insecure attachment style tend to feel inadequate and unworthy, and unsure if they truly matter to others. Given their personal history, they have doubts about others being reliably attentive, supportive, and trustworthy. Consequently, they tend either to keep their distance and not expect much, or to cling to other people. Having taken in relatively caring from others, they're less able to be compassionate toward themselves. Meanwhile, they've internalized put-downs and rejections and tend to be harshly self-critical. As a result, they're less resilient, less able to cope with stress and setbacks. Deep down, connection needs do not feel sufficiently met, and they're prone to entering the reactive mode in their relationships. Secure in the core of your being. Conceptual models need to make sharp distinctions, but reality is fuzzier. Secure and insecure attachment styles are at opposite ends of a range, like a color spectrum with bright green at one end and bright red at the other, and a lot of messy complexity in the middle. Wherever you are in this range, you can move toward a greater sense of security, both inside particular relationships and with people in general. The plasticity of the nervous system that makes us so easily affected by bad experiences in relationships also enables us to heal and grow from good ones, and to become more secure, more centered in the green zone with others, over time. Take in feeling cared about. Experiences today may not have everything that would have been so good to have received as a child or adult, but at least they can offer part of what was missing for you. Caring comes in five major forms with increasing intensity: being included, seen, appreciated, liked, and loved. Each one of these is an opportunity to feel cared about. Over time, repeatedly internalizing these experiences can build up a basis for secure attachment. As you go through your day, look for the little moments in which another person is interested, friendly, grateful, empathic, respectful, affectionate, or loving. Other things may be happening in that relationship which are not so positive for you, but whatever is good for you is still real. Use the heal steps to turn the recognition of caring for you into an experience that you stay with for a few breaths or longer, taking it into yourself. Most of the times you do this will be brief and mild, though you can also have more intense experiences, such as a deep sense of closeness with your partner. Experience by experience, synapse by synapse, you'll be growing a core in yourself that feels valued, liked, and loved, a solid base for real confidence. And for a longer, sustained experience of this, try the experiential practice that follows. Experiential practice, feeling cared about. Think of people who matter to you. Be mindful of what it's like to feel caring toward them. See some of the ways that it is good for them to feel cared about. Turn it around and consider that it is good for you to feel cared about, and that it is normal and all right for you to want this. Think of beings who care about you today or who have cared about you in the past. They could be individuals, a group of people, a pet, or a spiritual consciousness. Any form of caring counts. Recognize the fact that you are currently cared about in various ways and that you have been cared about. Let your knowing of this fact become an experience of feeling included, seen, appreciated, liked, or loved. Focus on the sense of being cared about. If other thoughts and feelings come up, disengage from them and return attention to feeling cared about. Enrich this experience by protecting it and keeping it going. Feel it in your body, perhaps with a hand on your heart. Notice what feels reassuring, comforting, or enjoyable about this experience. If you like, use the link step to connect this sense of being cared about with feelings of being left out or mistreated, inadequate or ashamed. Imagine that you are receiving caring into soft, yearning, young places inside. Take caring into yourself like a soothing balm for hurts and wounds. Know that you are worth being cared about. Let this knowledge spread inside you like light moving into shadows of self-doubt. As always with linking, emphasize the positive material, drop the negative if it's too powerful, and finish by focusing only on positive material. Develop a coherent narrative. Research has shown that people who are insecurely attached as children can develop secure attachment as adults. A key step is to develop a realistic, integrated, coherent account of what happened when you were young and how that affected you. This is a gradual process that can take many months, even years. I've been reflecting on my own childhood for a long time, and new things are still clarifying for me. Imagine how a fair-minded and warm-hearted person would tell the true story of your childhood, year by year, from your birth to when you left home. Think about your parents and other influential people in your life as complex individuals with different parts inside, pulling in different directions. Try to see pain, loss, stress, mistreatment, or trauma for what it was and how it landed on you. Also try to see the love, friendship, affection, loyalty, and support you received. Step back and consider the years unfolding, everything that happened, how you reacted, and why. See how your childhood, including adolescence, naturally left traces behind. See the strengths that were developed and the wounds. With compassion for yourself, try to be matter of fact about the whole story of your childhood. Look for the common humanity in it, the threads of it that are shared with others. No matter how fragmented and confusing it might have been, you can find security in a coherent and clear understanding of it. And, to reflect on your childhood in a structured way, try the experiential practice that follows. Experiential practice, reflecting on your childhood. Adapt these questions to your own background. For many of them, you won't have specific recollections, but you could have a sense in your body or an intuition about the answer. You might also have a good guess from what you know about your childhood, perhaps from other people. Try to bring compassion to anything that is painful or upsetting. What was the first year of life like for you? Were you born preterm? Did you have health issues? Were your parents sensitive to your needs? When you cried, what usually happened? Was either of your parents significantly affected by depression, alcohol, or relationship issues? What was it like to be a toddler and then a preschooler? When you said no, how did your parents react? If you had siblings, how did that affect you? What kind of relationship did your parents have with each other? And how did that affect your family? What was it like in grade school? Did you feel popular? What kind of friends did you have? Did you feel included? Were you bullied? What was it like to be a teenager? Did you feel confident or insecure? How did the changes in your body affect you socially? How did you get along with your parents? Did you feel seen and supported by them? Looking back, what else made a big difference for you? Perhaps a divorce, frequent moves, financial problems, major illness or death in the family, a sibling with special needs, or a larger context of poverty or prejudice. Did anything traumatic happen to you, including abuse, injury, or shocking loss? Were there any people who especially protected or nurtured you, such as a grandparent, teacher, or best friend? How has all this affected you in your relationships? How are you still affected today? Help others attach securely to you. One of the amazing things about becoming a parent was that loving our kids wasn't good just for them. It also slowly repaired the wounds and empty places inside me. It's almost magical. By giving what we didn't get, we receive something good ourselves. Some relationships are relatively superficial, while others are very deep, such as a profound connection with a life partner. In the context of whatever the relationship is, other people can feel secure with you when you are dependable, empathic, and caring. They may still need to deal with their own forms of insecure attachment, but at least you are doing your part. This increases the odds that others will treat you reasonably well, giving you opportunities to have and internalize experiences that will add to a secure core inside yourself. There is something mysteriously reparative about treating others as you wish to be treated yourself. It feels like a mending inside of what's been torn or tattered. It's also an affirmation that no matter what happened to you, your innermost being is intact. You can still be good to others. And you can still love. Don't throw darts. Think of a time when someone mistreated you and recall your immediate reactions. You could have experienced something like surprise, hurt, and anger. And then what happened inside your mind? A follow-on cascade of thoughts and feelings is very common. For example, as I have, you might have stayed awake at night thinking about what you wished you had said. A 1-2 punch. This two-step process of initial and then secondary reactions was described as the first and second dart by the Buddha. The first dart is unavoidable physical or emotional discomfort and pain, such as a headache, the cramping of stomach flu, the sadness at losing a friend, or the shock at being unfairly attacked in a meeting at work. The second dart is the one we throw ourselves, adding unnecessary reactions to the conditions of life and its occasional first darts. For example, second darts include getting really worried about a minor misunderstanding with another person, brooding about being slighted, and holding on to resentments and grudges. Second darts are the source of so much human suffering, especially in our relationships. They make us more upset than we need to be and cause us to do things we regret later. To some extent, you can prevent first darts by changing the situations and relationships that affect you. For example, you might be able to find a less stressful job or spend less time with a difficult relative. Also, as we've been exploring, you can develop an increasingly robust core of peace, contentment, and love that functions as an internal shock absorber. Then, certain situations and relationships that used to be first darts for you will bother you less, if at all. Yet many first darts will still come to every person. When a first dart lands, it's there, and you cannot change the fact of it. The brick has dropped on your foot and it hurts. Someone has yelled at you and you're startled and angry. You feel what you feel. When this happens, you can use